Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. It's a great honour on behalf of Books Etc. to welcome this evening Roddy Doyle and Nick Hornby. I'm not really going to say a great deal about either of these gentlemen, as I think they're much more capable of talking about themselves than I am. I just want to tell you a little bit about the format for the evening. There's going to be a discussion between our two guests. There's going to be a reading by Roddy Doyle, and there'll be an opportunity to ask questions at the end. So please do be thinking of what you might like to ask. We've got a couple of roving mics, so it's going to be just a case of putting your hand up and waiting for the mic to come towards you. But without any further ado, would you please welcome Roddy Doyle and Nick Hornby.
Thank you very much. I'm going to read two passages from this book, A Star Called Henry. The first is from very early on in the book, where the narrator, Henry Smart, describes his birth. It's a long passage, followed by a shorter one from further on in the book. The only thing you really need to know is that Henry's father's name is also Henry, and he has a wooden leg. Henry rushed. He skipped all the way, but he dreaded the quick trip home and what he'd find there. Melody was about to give birth. Again. Two children had come into the room over Silver Alley, but neither of them had stayed. Henry and Lil. Their final coughs still roamed through Henry's ears. Neither got past the first year. There'd been other losses, miscarriages. They'd moved to another room in another house across Silver Alley. Melody looked over at her old window and saw her children's faces pressing against the cracked glass. They moved again to a house at Summer Hill. The room was smaller, the house meaner, and moving was easy. Henry borrowed a handcart and up went the mattress and the chair and stool. Everything else went into the tea chests, the blue statue of Our Lady, the sheets and blanket, the extra leg. They still had the knives and forks, but the spoon had gone missing. There was nothing new to put into the tea chests. Henry pushed his failure through the streets to Summer Hill. He passed carts, met others, some overflowing with bed frames, rags, children and grandparents, others next to empty, families on the move. Henry longed for a child to park on top of the handcart. Up darker, damper stairs, through a door that promised nothing. There was a window that let them look out at the yards behind the... There was a window that let them look out at the yards behind the house. The window box still waited for flowers. This was the room that Henry was rushing home to. This was their last chance. He was sure of it. He was panting when he turned onto Summer Hill. He was getting old. He was 26. His hair was greying, although he hadn't seen it. He was stooped, carrying the heavy ghosts of his children. He could still feel them in his arms. He could smell them. Little Henry, little Lil. His love for them was an unending fight in his chest. He was always on the verge of seeing them. He didn't sleep anymore. Henry was terrified. Granny Nash was putting sheets of newspaper on the mattress, pages of the Evening Mail and the Freeman's Journal. "The Baba will have plenty to read anyway," said Mrs. Drake. Mrs. Drake was the local midwife, the handy woman. She was a huge woman, a mass of muscle and slopes that looked like babies' heads, bursting to get out. Melody wondered, was there one in there for her? Hoped and hoped there was. She sat on the chair and watched her mother laying the pages of paper on the bed. The buckets were full, one with hot, the other with cold water. The kettle was steaming. "They say if there's news of a war on any of the pages, then it'll be a girl," said Granny Nash. She couldn't read the headlines she was spreading on the mattress. She was finished now. The papers were flat and orderly, and her hands were black. Mrs. Drake was over at the window. "Don't open it," said Granny Nash, as she gave the papers a last pat. "Till we've ourselves down on the paper, else they'll all blow away on me. Now, my lady," she said to my mother, her daughter, "up you get now." Melody stood up out of the chair. Elephant. Melody, Melody, Elephant Melody. It was cruel, all over again. It was only 11 months since the last time she'd had to lie down on newspaper. She struggled a few feet to the mattress. "Good girl yourself," said Mrs. Drake. "Off you go." Melody lay back on the newspapers. They cracked and rustled under her, and Mrs. Drake lifted the window. "That's a grand-looking day out there," she said. "A smashing day for bringing a baba into the world." The steam dashed to the open window, and the pain dashed through Melody. "Stop whinging," said Granny Nash. "You'll give the child a hair lip." "None of that shitery now," said Mrs. Drake to Granny Nash as she rolled over to Melody. "You're in charge of the water. Any more guff out of you and I'll fling you out the window, and then we'll hear some whinging." And Melody started laughing. More pain thumped her back right off the mattress, but she was still laughing when she landed. Henry waited out on the street. He didn't want to be too near. He paced back and forth, watched at windows by hundreds of people who knew and feared his tap-tap. Henry saw none of them. There was no window of his own to look up at. He was on the wrong side of the house. He went through the house to the yard and looked up at his window. It was open. He listened. Nothing. He couldn't stay there. He felt trapped. His coat felt like armour. He'd be to blame if it went wrong again, if the baby didn't live. It was an idea that had become a rock-solid conviction in the time it had taken him to get from Dolly Oblong's to the house. It would be all his fault. He listened as he went to the back door and heard Melody laughing. She pushed. Good girl, there's no rush. Give yourself a rest. Mrs. Drake gathered the sweat from Melody's brow with a cloth that was gorgeously cold. Granny Nash peered between Melody's legs. She didn't have to bend. Get away from there, you, said Mrs. Drake. You'll frighten the baba. Melody laughed and pushed again. Henry, back out in the street, wore half an inch off his leg as he stomped back and back again. He tried leaning on the railing, sitting on the steps, but he couldn't stay still. He had to move. He thought about going for a pint or something smaller and stronger. His nerves were in dire need of settling. But he didn't want to leave his post. She'd laughed. It was years since he'd heard her laughing. He was so frightened, he was terrified that that laugh would be the last thing he'd ever know of Melody. And it would be his fault, because of what he was. He hadn't noticed it getting dark. It was suddenly night. A bad sign, a bad sign. Poor Henry tried to ignore it. Night followed day. He ignored it. He ignored it. Melody pushed. Henry's leg got shorter and shorter. He listened to the fading echo of his wife's laughter. Melody pushed. He tried to hear, tried to remember it. He didn't notice that he was listening dangerously, dangling over the basement steps. Melody heaved. Her back was turning to screaming stone. It's a hairy head. Get out of me, light. Mrs. Drake cupped the head in her magical mitts. The warmth of it, she said inside. There's power there, I'll tell you. Welcome home, my treasure. Melody pushed again. Henry toppled into the well of the basement. Melody pushed, and I, me, Henry Smart, the second or third, came charging into the world on a river of water and blood that washed the news off the papers. Melody fell back on the mattress. Mrs. Drake held me up by the legs. She dangled me for all to see. Like an almighty salmon she couldn't believe she'd caught. It's a lad, Mrs. Melody, she said. He must be more than a stone. A lad in a feckin' half he is. His cord is as wide as me wrist. She slapped my arse and the air around us sang. Granny Nash blessed herself, then hightailed her out the door to tell my father. Henry, my dad, looked up from where he'd landed on his back on the rubbish and waste blown down from the street. A shooting star went scooting across the black sky over Dublin. Henry forgot his pain and whooped. He saw Granny Nash squinting through the railings, trying to find him in the gloom and rubbish. I know, said Henry. I know. Where were the three wise men? Where were the sheep and the shepherds? They missed it, the fucking eejits. They were following the wrong star. They missed the birth of Henry Smart, Henry S. Smart, the one and only me, on the 8th of October 1901 at 22 minutes past 7. They all missed it. Mrs. Drake was there. Her hands that cupped my head tingled for the rest of her great long life. Granny Nash was there. She picked up the Freeman's Journal and discovered that she could read. And my parents, they were happy. For a tiny moment in their hard, hard lives, my mammy and daddy were happy. I was a broth of an infant, the wonder of Summer Hill and beyond. I was the big news, a local legend within hours of landing on the papers. They say that he was born with the teeth already in his head. She has to use the blanket off the bed for his nappy. A woman seen him said he had enough meat on him to make triplets. The local Elwyn's all queued up, across the landing, down the stairs, out onto the street to have a deco at me. The stairs groaned and threatened to cave in, but the prospect of falling into the black well and the waiting rats below wouldn't budge the Elwyn's. They had to see the famous baby. It wasn't the weight of me they wanted to see. Big brats were 10 a penny and cheaper. It was the glow. I was the glowing baby. I lay in a crib that was really an old zinc basin, nicely stuffed and padded, and I beamed out good health and vitality. I was pink and cream. Every little movement of my adorable fists or face seemed to predict a bright future. The visiting women all looked at me, the great big bonny lad, and smiled. They said nothing. They said little, nothing that wasn't pleasant. Lots of soft oohs and ahs and sighs that joined the sunlight. They nodded to my mother and to Mrs. Drake, who was still looking after her until after she'd been churched, and all walked home happy. The women who'd seen me went through the rest of the day feeling special. Ailing, fading women found long-forgotten spring in their steps. Unhappy women caught themselves smiling. Grieving women tried to sing and found that they could. The glowing baby had entered their lives and tickled their misery with his pudgy wee fingers. But that was all I was, a healthy, good-sized baby. The women had never seen one before. They looked at me and saw a fine lad who was going to live. There was no doubt about it at all, not a shadow. That was my miracle. I glowed guaranteed life. No fever would ever topple me. No cough would ever steal my last breath. Only a week in the world, and already there were stories spinning up and down the streets and alleys through the open windows of the slums. There was the one about the rat family sitting on the rim of the basin looking in at me. Mammy rat, daddy, the rat children and all their relations, tamed by my brightness when my mother woke up and saw them. She sat up and screamed, and they left calmly, out through a hole in the skirting board. The last one looked back and winked. Seen them with her own eyes, she did. They all marched off, like they were on their way to mass. There was the one about Lady Gregory's head gardener, knocking on the door, wanting to buy whatever fell into my nappy to spread around Lady Gregory's rose bushes. There'd be a man with a carriage and a bucket to carry my shite west to cool every evening. Henry Smart the second or third, Henry, but not yet named, was famous. Henry Smart the first, my father, was already famous. Still a bigger legend than his newly arrived son, the tap-tap of his famous leg was a sound more feared than the banshee's wail. The banshee wasn't folklore. The banshee was a fact, an evil old hag perched on the roofs of the houses, combing her matted rat-tailed hair, announcing the coming of death. She was a busy woman. Everyone had seen and heard her. My mother saw her many times. I saw her every time Granny Nash walked in the door. After my birth, my father was also born, a new man, again. Every time he picked me up and felt the life bounding through me, he felt newer still. He held me gently, made an armchair of his colossal hands for me. He sat on his chair, and I sat in him. He inhaled with me and exhaled. And he sang to me, "Oh, the bridge it broke down and they all tumbled in." This baby hadn't been snatched away, never would be snatched away from him. "We'll go home be the water," says Brian O'Lynn. My father adored me. "Aren't they the picture?" said Mrs. Drake. "Yes," said my mother. "A fine pair of men," said Mrs. Drake. "Yes," said Melody. The room was full of food, offerings left behind by the visiting women. There was a sheep's head, pig's feet, a big bag of winkles. There were bananas, apples, an orange. There was fancy bread and two buns fecked from Bewley's. Mrs. Drake was skinning a rabbit. "This boy was out running this morning," she said. "The wind is still in his fur. Can you smell it?" "No," said Melody. "I can," said Henry, but he was smelling me. My mother was still in bed, 7 days after my birth. Mrs. Drake wouldn't let her get up yet. Anyway, my father had the chair, and the stool was somewhere under Mrs. Drake. There was nowhere else for Melody to sit. She wasn't to do any cooking until after she'd gone to the church and kneeled in front of the priest. She wasn't to cut bread, peel a spud, anything. She'd contaminate the food and poison a lot of us if she laid a finger on it before the priest's blessing had cleansed her. Melody was enjoying the luxury. For the first time in her life, she was doing nothing. Mrs. Drake was lowering the gutted bunny into the pot. My father stood and brought me over to my mother, holding me like a present he'd saved all his life to buy her. I left his confident hands and landed in my mother's. "In you go now," said Mrs. Drake to the disappearing rabbit. "And mind you don't eat all the carrots." My father sat on the bed. The air around him smelt of cleanliness and hope, soon to be joined by the stew. He felt good, strong. In the months coming up to my birth, an idea had taken hold and attached itself to the lining of his gut. He was to blame. It had clung, fed on him. It had grown and shoved its way through his body. He was to blame for the deaths of all his children. It had slithered into every cell. His children had been taken from him, and Melody, because of all the things he had done, all the messages he'd delivered, all the people he'd scared just by walking, tap, tap, all the money he'd squeezed out of people with no money, all the skulls his leg had dented, all the men he'd murdered, and women. His children had been the price of all that for all that bullying and killing, all that badness. And all the bodies he'd disposed of, let slide into the waters that crawled their way through Dublin, let slide or just through. There was one man called Trainer, fed into the Talca in four neat pieces. There was a man called Farrell, who'd been caught taking money from three of Dolly's girls. There were men whose names and crimes he never knew. Into the Liffey and the Talca they went, and the other hidden rivers that ran under the city, nibbling away at its floor, or overland against high, forgotten walls, through places that led nowhere and where no one ever looked. They were Dublin's secret rivers, and my father knew them all. The Poddle and the Hangman's Stream, the Brad Oak and the Cemetery Drain. He knew them all. His leg divined them. They took his offerings and kept them. And there were other bodies, vanished without the help of water. There was Costello, the fat Rosser. Costello, the greedy Rosser. Alfie Gandon says hello. Costello had been fed to pigs in a farm beyond Talla, a farm with a beautiful view of the city. There were other men who'd ended up in the pigs and then on the mourning plates of the city's merchants and chancers, on the plates of their wives and brats, eating Henry's messages. There'd been a man called Lynch and another called O'Grady. There'd been a man with a huge purple birthmark pouring out of the neck of his shirt and another so handsome that Henry had almost let him go. And the women. There'd been two of the girls, got rid of for reasons he knew nothing about and never asked. One of them already dead, wrapped in bloody sheets, a parcel waiting on the bed. The other he'd killed, brought her for a walk. She told him about the town in Galway she'd come from, the last town before Boston, and about her family and her sister the nun, and her brother the fisherman, and about how none of them knew where she was or what she did, and that was when he'd killed her. Susie, and the other one was Antoinette, and both of them renamed Maria. They'd both gone into the river. He'd had nothing against any of them, the women or the men. He'd just done what he'd been told to do. He did a good professional job, never got involved. He did what hundreds of others in the city were doing or waiting to do. Alfie Gandon says hello. Once, just once, for some reason he didn't understand, for a change, he whispered a different message. Alfie Gandon says goodbye. Melody's eyes were closed. Mrs. Drake was humming. The stew was bubbling cheerfully. The rabbit was bobbing, sinking, falling apart into strings and chunks that Henry was looking forward to. He inhaled the fresh luxury, the certain knowledge that he was going to be fed. There was more than enough in the pot, enough for 2 days. There was nothing to worry about, more grub in the room than there'd ever been. The baby was asleep under Melody's breast. I was asleep under Melody's breast. Henry sat on the mattress. He'd put on his leg in a minute, but now he just wanted to rest in his happiness. For a while longer, for just a little while longer. I gurgled. He looked at me. He wanted to hold me again, but that would have meant disturbing Melody, and he didn't want to do that. She needed her rest. She looked young and unharmed, snoozing there. Henry smiled and gurgled back at me. My memory soup is full of my father's gurgles. I see a satisfied shape at the end of the bed. I feel my mother's breast pressing on my skull. I can smell her milk. I can taste it. Its bubbles are on my lips. My father was a happy man. "I'll soon be out of your way," said Mrs. Drake. "No hurry," said Henry. He liked Mrs. Drake. He felt grateful to her. She'd delivered me with the hands he now watched picking lint off her shawl, the hands that still tingled 7 days after my birth. And Granny Nash was afraid of her. It was days since he'd seen the old witch. He watched Mrs. Drake moving around the room, graceful and huge, patting things as if ordering them to stay put until the morning, reassuring them that she'd be back. She'd ruled the room for another 2 days. Henry watched her bringing the plates over to the pot. He would soon put on his leg. He had a new one, a beautiful, proud piece of mahogany. The old walked-away leg was up on the mantelpiece, beside the Blessed Virgin. He'd put on his new leg. They'd chat for a few minutes, then he'd kiss Melody and his unnamed son goodbye and go off to his work. I saw the shape at the end of the bed and another moving shape behind it, Mrs. Drake, a massive, light, warm shadow. My mother's tit rested on my head. I could hear and feel her heart. My ear was right on top of it, a velvet pounding that gave life to the shapes before me. I was ready to nod off. The shapes and noises loved me. There was a burp crawling its way up towards the milk left in my mouth. It was making good, tickling progress. I was enjoying it, looking forward to it. I delivered the burp. "There she blows," said Mrs. Drake, "the little creature." My father leaned across and wiped my mouth with his coat sleeve. That coat sleeve. My mother opened her eyes to the sight of Henry running his finger along the wee fat canyon that divided my chins. He felt the soft love of her eyes on him, and he leaned down the few more inches and kissed her breast. She pushed his head away, but she was thrilled, a push that was really a pull. They were in love like they'd never been. It was their new life, and me in the middle of it, the little one who'd started it. "I'll be off so," said Mrs. Drake. "Thanks very much, Mrs. Drake," said Melody. "Yeah," said Henry, and he nodded at the full plates now waiting for them on the tea chest. "Asher," said Mrs. Drake, "it's only a drop of water with a rabbit floating around in it." "It smells lovely," said Melody. "It was a handsome rabbit," said Mrs. Drake. I gurgled for Mrs. Drake. Twin dribbles ran over my chins, especially for her. She was gone. "Bye-bye, Mrs. Drake." Melody rubbed my back and lowered me into the zinc crib. I missed her heart. I looked up at a face, then a big grey space that was the ceiling. My parents sat at the tea chest and ate the stew. "Jesus, Melody," my father gasped. "The woman's a genius." "She is," my mother agreed. They sucked the soup off carrots, swallowed chunks of the bunny. They coughed and filled their mouths with bits of spud that melted to wonderful slush on their tongues. There was no room for talk. I listened to the music of the forks on plates and to the ferocious happy groans and gulps as they shoved Mrs. Drake's grub down pipes that had never known anything like it. My mother's breasts hummed to me. My lips searched for her. The groans and forks slowed and stopped. A screech. The chair scraping the floor. My father was on his way. I squirmed. I gulped. My lips nibbled the air. It was my turn now. My father strapped on his new leg. "There's a lovely shine off it," said Melody. "Only the best," said my father. She watched him, admired the speed and confidence. Then she spoke again. "What'll we call him, Henry?" I was the baby with no name. I'd been baptized quickly, on the spot. Water had hit my head before milk had gone near the back of my throat. God waited for no baby in the slums. He took them back as soon as he'd given them, but he threw them away if their souls were still stained. He delivered them soiled, but he expected them back spotless. It was a race. Each day of life was a fight and a triumph, an endless race to stay a few inches in front of the greedy hand of God. God's gift, original sin, had to be washed away in case God sent another of his gifts. Fever, typhoid or whooping cough, smallpox, pneumonia or rats. So I'd been baptized. I was without sin, but I didn't have a name either. Baba Smart, Mrs. Drake had said. That's not a name, said the priest. I know that, Father, said Mrs. Drake. I cannot give the sacrament to a nameless child, said the priest. Of course you can, Father, said Mrs. Drake. Sure, it'll only be temporary. They're not in a fit state to come up with a little name right now. Look at them, sure. The priest looked. An hour after I'd been born, my mother was asleep and giggling. My father was one-legged, bleeding and hanging onto the mantelpiece, trying to get his leg to stand up beside the Virgin. Happiness was pouring out of him in snot and tears. Granny Nash was reading the small ads in the Free Man's Journal, gasping as each word opened its meaning. There would be spoke suits going for 35 shillings and a parrot with talking warranty for only 12 and sixpence. She wondered how much the parrot would cost without the warranty. What's your own name, Father? Said Mrs. Drake. Cecil, said the priest. I let them know, said Mrs. Drake. Cecil the priest looked at me in Mrs. Drake's arms. He saw a magnificent baby, a baby with a glow and heft that offered immortality. He saw Cecil, the immortal baby. He saw the story of his name being passed from neighbour to daughter and on, the story of Father Cecil and the baby. So he gave in and baptised me with water from one of the cups, and I became temporary smart, Baba Smart, the boy without stain. He mumbled his mumbo voodoo and dabbled a trickle on my angry head. The immortal baby was now ready for his death. A week later, I was still alive and uncecilled. I was still the Baba. Mrs. Drake had never mentioned the priest Dean's name to my mother or father. She'd a cousin called Cecil, a wee pus-filled gurrier who'd made her young life a constant misery until he'd run under a tram. Even dead, he'd terrified her. Cecil was no name for her Baba. Mrs. Drake had told a lie to Cecil the priest. She was never going to recommend his ugly name to my parents. She'd taken the sin and swallowed it. My father let the trousers drop over the new leg. And then my mother spoke. What'll we call him, Henry? She said. My father looked at my mother and smiled. This was his moment. Henry, he said. If I'd been in her arms, she would have dropped me. No! My father was surprised and very quickly annoyed. He held back his anger, felt it battering his chest. Why not? My mother was trying not to get sick. She couldn't talk yet, not yet. There was nothing in front of her. Movement meant falling. But she was ready to believe. She'd imagined it. There was been some sort of mistake, a distortion made by the wind. She waited to be saved. Well, said my father, did the cat get your tongue or what? He was angry, but he didn't want to be. There was no enjoyment in it, no triumph. It was a fight he didn't want. He wished now that he'd never said the name. He'd have taken back the last minutes and started again, differently, if he could have. There were other names. He'd been thinking about it all week. He'd imagined the moment, a gift to Melody, handing it over to her. Henry. He'd been sure she'd have loved the idea. He'd been positive about it. Henry. The name would float between them. Just the two of them. A perfect moment. Just the two of them. And what about me? I was annoyed. I was hopping. I was struggling, squirming. There were two growing things, two smothering throbs, crawling over each other inside me. Two sensations that I was going to have to get used to. Hunger and neglect. Now, though, I was going to let go of a stream of roars and yaps in the sure knowledge that results would immediately follow. Hands would come and pick me up. Well, said my father, Melody. There was silence out there, beyond the crib. Not for long, though. The nameless baby would be heard. I was squirming, fretting, working myself up into a fit state for making noise. Melody? Yes. Are you all right? Yes. Do you not think it's a good idea? I heard a sob. My mother had got there just before me. I was furious now, robbed and ignored. Well? She sobbed again, then silence. Well? No. No what? No, I don't think it's... Sobs, a string of them, and silence. I sent out a string of my own, linked sausages full of protest and slobber, the strangled outcries of an angry wee man. Why not? What about me? I heard her breathing, measuring her breath. We already have a Henry. I sent out more exploding sausages. The zinc walls were closing in on me. But he's dead, said my father. I heard a gasp. My mother shook her head and hid behind her hair. He's dead, love, said my father. He wasn't being callous. He wasn't being cruel. The last sounds of his dead children were in his ears. He could measure their weights in his arms, but they were dead, gone from him and Melody. My father didn't believe in heaven or afterlife reunions. His children were gone. Naming me Henry would take the pain and weight away. It would let them start again. It would let them include the dead in their new life, a gift to my mother. I was crying now, full blast. Everything was in my wail. "He's not," said my mother. "He is," said my father. "For God's sake, love, where is he? He's dead, and the other little one, they're dead. What about me? What about me?" I was a pink-cheeked howl in need of milk and arms. I was alone. My mother shook her head. She looked up at the ceiling, at her children beyond it, waiting for her. She looked up at her first Henry, her one and only Henry. "What about me?" My father looked up and saw the ceiling. Just the ceiling. Nothing but the grey, sagging, cracked, stained ceiling. "Stars are only stars," he said. "Melody." My mother looked through the ceiling. "What about me?" "Don't pretend you can see anything up there, love," said my father. "Look at me. Do you hear me?" My father was angry and not interested in stopping. "It's the fucking ceiling," he shouted. He had to shout. I was making noise to drown anything else. I was becoming noise, adding to his anger. I was choking, screaming, disappearing. "It's a fucking ceiling and the stars are only stars and his name's Henry, do you hear me?" I was named. "His name's Henry. Henry, so you might as well get used to it." He got up, the chair fell back. He came over to the crib. I heard the charging tap-tap. He looked down at me. I saw an angry blur, shimmering fury. "Listen," he said to my mother. "Are you listening now?" He bent down. I felt his heat and roared into my purple face. "Henry! Henry! Shut up! Shut up, Henry! Shut up, Henry!" My mother kept shaking her head, hitting the name back with her damp curls. "Shut up, Henry!" Was I obedient? Did I obey my daddy? I did, like fuck. I screamed back up at him. My purple turned to black. I shoved my terror up into his face. And he stopped. He stopped shouting at me. He saw that I'd die before I'd stop. I'd scream my life away before I'd let him better me. "What about me?" So he stopped. He stood up straight and looked back down at me from a safe distance. He searched me, looking for some way past my screeches. His hands slowly surrounded me, gradually grew more solid. He picked me up. I left the crib behind. "There, there." He put me on his shoulder. "Now, now." I looked for a nipple in his coat. My lips met dust and blood. I tasted awful secrets. I kicked and shook. I fought his care and hands. He brought me quickly to my mother. Tap, tap, tap. I went from hands to smaller hands, shaking, frightened hands. Frightened faces watched me as I found a nipple, drank, and fell asleep. I was the other Henry, the shadow, the impostor. She still fed me, held me, doted on me. But when her husband was in the room, she began to feel sharp cuckoo lips on her breast. She stopped eating. There was no Mrs. Drake to coax food into her, and Granny Nash was too busy with her head in Knocknagow or Bleak House to be bothered with feeding herself, let alone her half-wit of a daughter. My father saw the food left on the plate, saw her fading. He cursed the vanity and sentimentality that had suckered him into giving me his old name. And he hated the sky over Dublin for not being thick enough and dirty enough to hide the stars. He hated the wind for making open curtains of the nighttime clouds. And he looked at me and saw a different child. He began to see the baby who was eating his wife away. He wanted to hold me, but sometimes, even as he bent over me, he couldn't lift his arms to do it. I was Henry, but they never called me that. She wouldn't, he couldn't. But I was still Henry, too late for any other name. So they called me nothing. I was the boy, the lad, himself, he, the child. I grew out of the zinc basin. My knees and elbows crushed its sides. I screamed as I stretched. My glow became a crust, my skin dry and furious. My mother swayed between fat and skeletal. She was a different woman every week. I went from breast to solids, straight from to spuds and chunks of gristle. I bit with teeth that were robbed from a graveyard. I crunched and swallowed everything that was put in front of me. I gnawed at my father's leg until he had to leave it on the landing before he came in. I struggled and walked and threw myself around the room. The ceiling shed its grey skin. It snowed all day on top of us. And there were no more visitors, no more ahs and sighs, no food left behind. I claimed the mattress, marked my boundaries with my muck. I stopped their sleep. I muscled in on their sex, their messy efforts at saving their love. I crawled all over legs and arses and bit whatever seemed soft. They picked me up, patted me, smacked my arse, fed me, loved me, cleaned me, but they never called me Henry. I flooded the room with my stinks and waxes. I roared and screamed my right to be named. I drove my mother out onto the step. She had to get away from walls. Already big and pregnant with the next one, she fumbled her way down the black stairs, trying to hold me on her suffering hip. She sat on the cold step and sweated. She waited for twilight and night. I beat her. I climbed onto her hair. I pressed into the breasts that were no longer mine. I scratched my sores and bled for her. She rocked me and soothed me, waited for the stars. It got darker and colder. I scratched her face. I puked white loaves on her shoulder and lap. She rocked me. She looked up at the sky and waited for the grey to turn black. She wrapped me in her shawl. She trapped my hands and legs. The North Star appeared. I fought against her arms. More stars lit up and twinkled. She held me tight. She gazed up at all the stars. She wandered from one to the next. She wrapped me tight in her shawl and lifted her free hand. I struggled to escape. I puffed and shook and spat. She lifted her hand and chose a star. Her index finger swayed, then stiffened. "There he is," she said. I bucked and tossed. I screeched blue murder. "There's my little Henry." The star grew and shimmered. Blood ran from my nose in a rush that failed to shock her. She put her shawl to my nostrils and continued to gaze at her star. She wasn't being vindictive. There was no cruelty in her pointing. She wanted me to see him, and him far away to see me. Henry met Henry. She hoped we could be friends, that we could love each other. She smiled as I screamed. That was what my father saw the moment I was born. The shooting star was Big Brother Henry charging across the sky in a fit of celestial jealousy. If my father had listened too, if Granny Nash hadn't distracted him, he'd have heard the star's wail slicing the heavens. "Mammy!" She turned my head to the star and held it firm. "See? See?" Years later, when I lay under my blanket on the lonesome prairie, full of beans and disgruntlement, or I sat on a rock in the Utah desert and shivered, I'd gaze up at the huge, cold, black-blue sky and I'd find the star. I always knew its sly twinkle and fade. It could never hide from me. I'd stare at it, fix my eyes on it, and refuse to let them stray to any of the other millions of its still and shooting siblings. I'd stare at my star till I knew I had it. I'd make a copper rope of my gaze and I'd lasso the twinkling bollocks. Then I'd yell, "My name is Henry Smart!" I'd watch it shimmer and fuss. My voice was hard and sure and triumphant, hard as the rock I was sitting on, cold as the air that was lying on top of me. There was no one else to hear me. My nearest neighbors were as distant as the stars above me. "My name is Henry Smart, the one and only Henry Smart!" I'd watch its gases splutter and die. "My name is Henry Smart!" I'd yell until I could no longer see its shadow against the blueness of the night, until there was nothing out there. I killed my brother every night. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Nineteen years later, Henry is a member of the IRB, or what became the IRA. And just by way of very brief introduction to this piece, what I was trying to do in this section of the book was to walk a line between the excitement that the young people, men and women, who got involved in the Republican movement must have felt as they went out and started inventing something new, and the brutality of what they experienced, did and saw. And this is a lighter piece. Those of you who are familiar with Ireland know that the holy statues refuse to stay still. They don't obey the basic laws of physics. Stone wobbles, plaster bleeds. So if you know Ireland and you're familiar with it and like, you just accept it. You don't try to prove it wrong. So this chapter is inspired by an event which occurred in Templemore, County Tipperary, in 1921, when the statues moved and bled. Henry has been sent. Sorry. You know, I couldn't. I'm dying here, you know. I'll try, okay? Henry Smart is sent by, on the direct orders of Michael Collins, to Templemore to stoke the miracle, so to speak. We got in with the crowds descending on the town, a crawl of farm carts and bicycles, charabancs, motor cars, and pilgrims like ourselves on foot. The walking wounded and men and women on stretchers, carried by their children, and children coughing blood, men carrying the damage of war, legless, armless, skinless, the slobbering, brainless, and the best of Ireland's freaks. They were all on the road to town. Pinheads, hunchbacks, dwarfs, a couple of bearded ladies. They were travelling together in a battered Ford, hanging off it, on the roof or walking along beside it. We got in among them. An old soldier got his knee back working. I heard that one. And a lady from Thurles got her back straightened. There was a girl cured of her consumption yesterday, I said. Any news of little men made taller, said a dwarf. And him and his friends laughed and didn't mind a bit when other people joined in. And deeper into the town, the rosaries started, and with the heat and packing and excitement and news of the miracles, people started fainting and bodies were lifted over heads to doorways through upstairs windows. I'll sing a hymn to Mary. The impatient sick made their ways along the roofs. A man holding a crutch in his teeth slid over the slates towards the shop with the statues. Mother of Christ, Star of the Sea. And the dwarfs sang hymns of their own. Pray for the midget, pray for me. A bald man went home yesterday with a head of hair. If it's curing vanity she is, there's hope for us all. Scalped he was after the tan set a fire to him. Still and all, a good cap would satisfy most men. The best of the statues and a couple of the pictures had been moved out into a yard behind the shop. They were on a table on top of a white cloth. When the yard was full, when the shopman's cousin decided that there was room for no more pilgrims, the shopman's wife led a decade of the rosary and the crowd were given 2 more minutes to have their fill of the statues. There was an untarred telegraph pole on its side across the yard, in front of the table, like an altar rail, and the lucky ones at the front could kneel and rest their elbows on it while they waited for something to happen. The yard was emptied after the 2 minutes, measured out by the cousin on his own watch. There was only the one gate, so it was a push between those coming and going. When the yard was empty, it was filled again. Another decade, another push, screams and admonitions, curses and last prayers. Mind the baby! What a place to bring a baby! It's a dying baby, bad cess to you. Maybe the dying's been reversed. Maybe. We'll see. The might. There's colour there in the poor creature's cheeks. Look. We'll see. That's fine colour. Please God. We'll see. This had been going on for 5 days. Not a peeler or tan in sight. The town was in the hands of the pilgrims and hawkers and the North Tipperary Brigade of the IRA. They were running guns and bombs through Templemore under cover of the lame in the carts and cars of the near dead. There were crates of mineral bottles full of petrol, brown parcels of gelignite being passed over the heads of the crowd and wanted men hiding in every second attic. The armoured cars and tenders were in the barracks yard, going nowhere because of the crush in the streets. The town was a free state. The seminarian who'd seen the first blood was at home, exhausted, sliding in and out of consciousness, and a grand layer of straw had been laid on the cobbles under the poor lad's window to swallow the noise that was disturbing him and keeping him from his recovery. The street where his mother's house had been renamed Whispering Street. There'd been no miracles, only the rumours distributed by the men and women of the North Tip Brigade. The statues had stopped bleeding, and the seminarian wasn't there to get them flowing again. But I was. We pushed through the silent people, leaving. What did you see? The backs of many heads. No blood? No blood. We shoved our way to the middle of the crowd. We stepped over stretchers, got tripped by crutches and little men. The shopman's wife was looking cross and important. She had her daughters near her, in charge of the altar table. A statue of the Virgin, a crucifix, a sacred heart, warped and stained behind the old glass. I saw no blood. I see it. I whispered it, a tiny worm on a hook. What do you see, young fella? Oh, my God, I said. I see the blood. It's pouring from her eyes. He sees it. It's pouring out of her. He sees it. The shopman's wife yelled, hush. We were crowding into her rosary. The young fella sees it. They were turning and trying to turn, the crowd in front of me and beside. Someone fell, away to the left. There was shoving and counter-shoving, whispers and yells. I see it too, Miss O'Shea shouted, as she got her hand under my coat and pulled the tie. Something's happening, I yelled. The pain, oh mother of God! And it was fucking painful. My leg had been packed up at my arse for hours. Released, it roared, the blood pushed as my foot dropped to the ground. I fell. I clutched my knee and unstrapped the wooden leg. I held it up. His legs after growing! The new bare leg stuck out from under my coat. I gave it a twitch and another one. For all around me, the people fell to their knees. I hid a sharp stone in my hand. I cut the skin beside the knee and gave them running blood. There was howling and more fainting. One of the dwarfs looked over the heads of the kneeling throng. It's a grand long one, he said. More power to you, young fella. He couldn't hide the sadness on his face, but he nodded across at me. Miss O'Shea pinched my thigh. Did you feel that, Michael? Yes, I felt it. It's flesh and sore with it. The Virgin's after giving my brother the leg he lost when the fox bit him. 20 years ago. It's not in Our Lady's power to give anyone a leg, said the shopman's wife. It is through her intercession, but no one was listening to her. Even her daughters had abandoned the altar and were climbing over the telegraph pole and kneeling pilgrims to get a good look at the fine man with the new leg. 20 years he's been without the leg, said Miss O'Shea. Stand back, stand back. She slapped 2 of the shopman's daughters back against the wall of pilgrims that surrounded us. Can you stand up, Michael? I don't know, I said. She helped me to my feet. I put weight on the new leg. It's just like the other one, I said. I walked in the small circle, left me by the crowd, then trotted, then ran. The pilgrims laughed and applauded, hugged one another, reached out to touch me as I dashed past, and others cried and shook and hit their own ailments. I stopped and lifted the wooden leg to the sky. I won't be needing you anymore, I yelled. Give it here, young fella, said the dwarf. I spoke to the leg. But I'll keep you with me as a reminder of this day. Is the real one not reminder enough for you? And look, said an old lad who'd just got to the front of the crowd. Look at his foot. He got a boot with the leg that's a perfect match for the other one. That's Our Lady for you, boy. Who else but herself would have thought of that? They were stopped by a scream. It was one of the daughters. I see the blood! I see the blood! They turned and pushed for the next miracle, and there was a man standing right against me. Dublin, he said softly. I'll need trousers. They're all arranged. Will they match the jacket? They won't, but we've a new jacket for you as well, a suit. Will it fit? Your measurements came down from Dublin with the order. Good Jesus, I said. We can't lose. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Before we talk about A Star Called Henry, I'd like to ask you about your writing style, which I think is incredibly distinctive. A friend of mine who was reading A Star Called Henry said he didn't think there was a comma on it for the first 40 pages. The very short sentences that there's always been in your work. Was that, did it come out like that?
In this particular book or generally?
Yeah, generally. I mean, your style's always been like that, with sort of main clauses, not so many subordinate clauses, very spare.
It's 6 years since I taught, so I can't remember what a subordinate clause is. I've sort of a vague recollection of what they are. I've always, when I edit a book, it's always been trimming back to the bare essentials. In this case, with the new book, I was writing about some place that was very foreign to me, the past. And it's set in the middle of Dublin, where he's born is, I think, less than 3 miles from my own house, but in fact, it's not there at all. You know, the people, I think, in some sense, are there. The spirit of the place is some way intact, in some sort of a way that could never be defined. It might be just me being sentimental, but the place itself is gone. So I had to do a lot of research, and I had to pack the book with detail, the diet of the people, the folklore that's gone, not so much the way they spoke, because I don't think it's all that different. But I took for granted when I was writing the other books that people knew what I was describing, so I didn't bother describing it, to be honest with you. But in this case, I had to describe. But I still trim it back. I put in everything. I had to know everything. I put in everything, and then in the editing, I took most of it out again. So the writing is more packed, I suspect. But it's just, I suppose, the books have always been very close to the first person. They've either been written in the first person, or in the case of The Commitments, particularly in The Commitments, there was no person at all. It was like, there was no narrator really at all. It was just as near to, I felt it was as near to watching these kids doing what they were doing as I could possibly achieve. So I've always been very close to the characters. And I try to capture, if you like, I don't try to capture exact speech, because that would be hideous. But I try to capture a sort of trimmed form of speech. But I did take liberties. I was more, I think there's a lot more in this book than in the previous ones. But the style, I suppose, is the same. Yeah. I don't have a name for it.
Doylesque.
Yeah, that sounds all right. We'll settle on that one. So,
would you like to say a little bit, for those who haven't read it, about the time scale of this particular book, and therefore roughly what the major events are?
You want a brief history of Ireland?
Nick? Well, yeah, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, luckily we have an overhead projector behind us. Well, I was very keen to write a book. For a long, long time, I'd wanted to write a book about an old man. I wanted to write something like an old-fashioned book, Dickensian type of thing, at the beginning, an old man's life carried through to the end, like David Copperfield, for want of, you know, the best example I can think of. And more recently then, there was Illywacker, Peter Carey's novel, which I must have read about 17 or 18 years ago, and I really loved it, and it stuck with me a long time. So I thought, when I was finished The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, this was, to get rid of Paula Spencer's voice and to clear that out, I'd try this. And so in 1995, when I started it, I thought, well, if he's born in 1902 or thereabouts, it's just about feasible, if he's physically exceptional and mentally exceptional, it's just about feasible that he could be sitting down and writing the book. So that's where it came from. And then I had a list. At first, he was going to be a monumental liar. He was going to lie his way right through the 20th century, not just in Ireland, but the whole globe. And I had a list of things that he would do or claim to have done. He assassinated Kennedy. He was Elvis Presley's chef for a while. He disappeared down the Amazon for 10 years. I reckon he'd need a break. And
I kind of fancied going to up or down the Amazon. I'm not sure, is it up? I have a degree in geography, so I should know. Presumably it's up the Amazon. But I decided to abandon an awful lot of these. As I began to describe his childhood, the liar part of him became less important because it seemed much more sincere or true than that. But I suppose having been born in Dublin, and it became 1901 because I got my sums wrong, I had it 1902, maths was never my strong point, and there was all sorts of figures. It was Dan Franklin spotted, I think, or some other astute observer and editor spotted that I had, you know, whatever about my writing, I can't count. So I had to double back, and he was born in 1901. So having been born in 1901 in Dublin, then there were all these, well, I suppose the big events in Irish history came lumbering up, and I had to decide, was he in the GPO in 1916? And I couldn't say no, you know? It was just a dreadful waste of an opportunity. I'd been sneering and giggling at the 1916 Rising for years. I'd played 1916 as a kid when I was 8, and it was the 50th anniversary of the 1916 Rising, and instead of cowboys and Indians, we ran out and played 1916, and I've got vivid memories that I'm making up here now of being executed against the back garden wall and things like that, and then having quicklime thrown on me, and then instant martyrdom. And it was all great. I loved it. And then later on, things got muddy and a bit, the 1916 Rising virtually disappeared. I think younger people than me who went to school in Ireland probably never heard of it. The 75th anniversary would have been in 1991, and we all remember the festivities that day. We don't, because there weren't any. It was an embarrassment because of what happened in the 70s, and the inheritors of this ideology or whatever started planting bombs in pubs and restaurants, and things got very, very ugly. So I was keen to play with it. I'm not being dismissive, or I hope I'm not anyway, but I was keen to play with it, very keen to see if I could mix fact and fiction, if I could poke fun at people I thought I wanted to poke fun at, and I had to look at the darker things as well. And there's family mythology as well that I was keen. I'm very respectful of my family and my parents' parents. Unfortunately, I never really knew them. They died before I could get to know them. But both my grandfathers were involved in some sort of shape in the IRA, but after 1916. The legend has it that my father's father missed the 1916 Rising because he went to the races in Fairy House. It was Easter. It was Easter Monday. And officially the thing was cancelled, so he went off to the races instead. It was a disappointing alternative to joining the revolution. But he was apparently involved later on. And there's all sorts of holes there. He was a quiet man. He didn't talk about it. You know, and my mother's father also was involved in some shape or form, was tried for sedition actually when he was very young, and during the War of Independence he was married in Liverpool, and nobody can account for it. Why was he in Liverpool? It's ironic perhaps that he just thought that the only place where they'd have a quiet honeymoon was in the heartland of the enemy. So they were married in Liverpool, but we'll never know, because my grandmother died when my mother was 3, and then my grandfather died, and he was another very quiet man, and he said nothing about it, and I think a lot of the people who were involved said nothing. So I was interested, not in filling the gaps, but because I can't and I won't, but I was always intrigued by the gaps, and kind of upset by gaps, because I never knew them. So I was interested in just seeing how far I could feed the story in that way. It was to be one story. It was to be just him to the beginning, but it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and there was 1916 Rising, which was actually quite easy, because he was in the GPO, which is a grand big building, and it's still there, so I could look at it. And it only went on for 5 days, so the research was relatively easier, and it's in a straight line, and I got to the end. And then the War of Independence was a big mess. You know, it was a war that was fought on bicycles, largely. Which appealed to me.
Yeah, bicycles figure large in the book.
They figure large in the book. Yeah, I revived the bike, and it took longer, and it was hard to capture. But then there was the Civil War, and I didn't want to go into another war. And anyway, I thought my character would never make it in the Civil War. He'd be dead. He wouldn't get through it. It was very, very ugly, and again, it's even quieter. Somebody showed me a history book that they'd had in school recently in the 1980s, and there's one paragraph about the Civil War. One lousy paragraph about the Civil War, you know? The fatality rate wasn't huge, but, you know, everybody knows Ireland, know that it divided the country right down the middle ever since, and still does to a degree. And we're not talking North and South, we're talking about the South, you know? Yeah. People still vote according to what side their parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents took in the Civil War. So, I thought the realistic thing, that Henry, like millions of other Irish people, gets out of Ireland. So I thought that was the place to stop this particular book. So now It's still a book about Irishness, I think. The new volume, I've started it, but it'll be years down the line. But he's elsewhere. So it's a much bigger project than I thought it would be. So I'm sort of like committed to it for possibly, it terrifies me saying it on Friday evening, possibly for another 10 years or so. Just as big, just as, I'll take breaks along the way, don't worry, I'll have holidays. I'll take the weekends off and go to the zoo, but this is it now. And I'll do film work and other things like that, just to reassure one or two people in the audience, but this is the big work.
And they
is
don't
this.
Have to read solid for 10 years, do
they? No, sure, they can't.
one thing that you said about A Star Called Henry recently that I think is, in a way, quite difficult for people to understand, which was that you said it was a novel, it wasn't history.
Well, what I'm making sure, and actually, to be fair, it hasn't really happened, as far as I can see in reviews. I haven't read them all, and I haven't read all the interviews and the commentaries. But I was worried that it would be read in a way that Neil Jordan's script was bandied around before the film was made, and historians were poking at it and picking at it and saying, this didn't happen, Michael Collins never said fuck. That sounded very familiar. And all sorts of things. And, you know, I was afraid that this was what happened, that people, you know, they'd get academic historians to review the book. Right. They wouldn't read a novel. They'd read it and look for the history. And fiction, whether it's good or bad fiction, makes bad history. And I wasn't interested in recording the facts. I was interested in using facts, changing them, ignoring some, adding others, you know. So Michael Collins was a real man, and I have him in my book. But and there are one or two things that he says that, as far as I know, are what he said. But the rest, then, is fiction. He has a fight with Henry Smart. Yeah. He didn't, because Henry Smart didn't exist. <you know? coughs> And so I was very keen to distance myself. I suppose it is, you know, I hate the genre things anyway. You know that some of the best writers are way in some far corner because they're crime writers. And I hate that. So I'm not worried that I'll end up in a sort of so romantic history doorstopper section. I'm not worried about that.
Georgette
at all.
Georgette Heyer or something like that.
Well, she might be in the audience.
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm not worried about that, but I was worried that it would be seen, because he marches through history, big history with a capital H, that I just felt that I was trying to, you know, head them off at the pass, I suppose. But as it happened in Ireland, certainly the literary editors, the editors of the papers have been terrific in that they've been very astute and I think wise in the selections of people they got to read the book and review it. But I was worried again that doing readings like this that somebody would stand up and say, that never happened, that never happened. And so that's what I was trying to...
Well, of that bit now, like the bit at the wedding, you know, when forever hold your peace. Is anyone going to... No, no one wants to do it. There are things... I mean, that thing that you were saying about people saying this never happened and that never happened... I mean, you've had that anyway in reviews of the rest of your work. I mean, people say this is not an accurate picture of Dublin or this.
Yeah, even when Family was broadcast, I mean, the media went out to Ballymun, where it had largely been filmed, looking for objections, you know. And some of them were quite fundamental and worth discussing and, you know, worthy of debate. And, but there was one guy who, I don't know, found him in the shopping centre somewhere in Ballymun. And there's a party scene in the first episode of Family where they play a game called Beer Hunter, which I, you know, I was told this was outrageous. Nobody played this. It was my brother taught, you know, who showed me, you know, how to play Beer Hunter. And you just shake the can and you put it to the side of your head and open. there was objections to this. And one of the objectors said that nobody drinks yellow pack beer around here. You know, it was in the supermarket. Somebody buys it. Probably somebody from outside Ballymun drives in, buys all the stuff, loads the cart, drives back out again. And so, yeah, everything I've been. And there was a woman at a party recently who at 4 a.m. or thereabouts cornered me and said she had never heard anyone in Dublin use the word fuck.
Really?
4 a.m. She was sober, I
Did
was...
Did you say fuck to her immediately?
No.
That would have proved your point.
Well, yeah, in a shallow kind of a way. Yeah. So... I said, well, I did say I thought it was quite extraordinary, but I didn't suggest for a minute she was telling a lie or anything like that. Her name was Helen Keller. But I was supposed... she wasn't going to let me go until I agreed with her. So that all the things I'd written were, you know... wrong and nonsense. So in the most trivial ways, people, I suppose you get it as well in some sense, most novelists do, that didn't happen, that couldn't have happened. And so, yeah, but this seemed to be bigger. There are, you know, and I don't want to be over-dramatic here, but there are still about 51, 52 men living in Ireland, most of them men, who wear balaclavas, who still take their legitimacy for what they do from things that were done and said way back then. Right. And they do it without blushing. They do it without giggling. They're quite happy to kill people who disagree with them. Now, I'm not being over-dramatic. I'm not on their target list, but... it's more, if you like, we're talking about more fundamental things than the word fuck here. Yeah. If you're Irish, that is.
Well, there's a very impressive bibliography at the back of the book. And there are a couple of things there I wanted to ask you about. One is 500 Great Books by Women, A Reader's Guide.
Yeah, well, it saved me the bother of reading the 500 books. It was a great coincidence, actually, and a lot of the reading was happy coincidence. I was, as you know, that Granny Nash, before Henry's birth, couldn't read. Immediately after his birth, she could read, so her world changed, and she started reading everything, and quickly decided that she preferred books written by women than men, right. You know? And I enjoyed that. So Henry is sent off to break into houses on the, you know, in the leafier suburbs of Dublin, and to come back with books written by women. So he scours the libraries, the bedside tables, comes back with suitcases full of books, and he's running out. You know, he basically Granny Nash has in her room every book by a woman that could be found in Dublin. So I was running out of titles, you know, because Jane Austen only had 6, I think. Nice. And then there were, and I was, again, these were books that would have been written before 1919 or so. So I was really struggling, really, really struggling. So luckily, this editor, Caroline White at Penguin Viking in New York had told me that she was working on this, and it arrived in the post, and it immediately saved my life, really. There was 500 titles, some of which I'd heard of, and some of which were marvellous titles. I can't remember any of them now, unfortunately, but some of them are in the book, and yeah, the titles themselves are brilliant. So Henry finds all these books and brings them back to Granny Nash.
What about The Rivers of Dublin?
The Rivers of Dublin...
Because there's a lot of water.
There's a lot of water, there's a lot of rivers. I think I just wanted to get away from strict realism, I suppose. I wanted it to be realistic, but through a big magnifying glass, and wobbling and changing. So that the underworld of Dublin exists, and Henry's father with the wooden leg can divine these rivers. And I was intrigued by it. I was given a book. I did a reading in a public library in Dublin. I was given a book called The Rivers of Dublin, which the City Corporation had published, and it was a beautiful thing. Just every stream and every river in Dublin was mapped out, and there was an account of the of its course. And I found out that there's a river under the water 50 yards or so from where I live, and there was one running right down Dame Street under the Olympia Theatre, which I hadn't a clue about. So I was trying to capture an old world, really a Victorian type of world, and I thought that's the way to do it, you know. And I liked the running water. I think people might see it as symbolically important, and I'm not mad keen on symbols, but they're there if anybody wants them. But it's just the secret rivers and the running water. So that book was a great help there as well. I pored over the maps for hours and hours. And all the names I used, when I went out into the countryside, I mixed real place names and fictional ones, and got a book about Irish place names and messed around. And there are jokey place names in the book. Tunrua is a townland in the book, and it means red arse, which is a joke that about 3 people get. And whereas the rivers in Dublin are all real ones, you know, and I just thought they were fascinating, really. So that's where, again, it was a happy accident. I was given the book after I did a reading.
And one more thing. There's a minor character in the book, but a Jewish guy. And there's a book here, is it called The Jews in...
Jews in 20th century Ireland.
I mean, that's not something that had ever occurred to me that would be kind of a byproduct of.
There were two things happened
in the 20s.
There were two things happened there for me in terms of suddenly being alert to the fact that there was something to be said about anti-Semitism. I don't recognise the tune. But
anyone want to answer their friend?
Not now, I'd say. An uncle of my mother's, a man called Robert Brennan, who was involved again in the he was a propagandist, he was a journalist, but a propagandist for the IRA in the 1920s, wrote a memoir called Allegiance. And it was a terrific book. It's been out of print since it was published, I think, and I'm not sure why, because it's very, very good. And He found himself just before curfew, there was a curfew, midnight curfew, stranded, away from any safe house, and in severe difficulty if he was caught. So he then remembered he knew a Latvian man called Mr. Klemanis, and he knocked at the door of his flat and was let in. And Mr. Klemanis immediately came alive for me in the book because he spoke with exclamation marks. He reminded me of Owen Meany in A Prayer for Owen Meany. Right. Remember the guy who spoke in capital letters? Yeah. I liked him immediately, and I thought, kind of as a tribute to my mother, on my mother's side of the family, it's a strange way to go about it. I take Mr. Klemanis. I looked up the phone book to see if there were any Klemanises in Dublin. There aren't, so I thought, well, he's out of copyright, so to speak, so I plonked him in my book. Yeah. And I made him Jewish because I didn't want it to be an obviously Jewish name, but I made him Jewish because I had been reading about Jews in 20th century Ireland and the anti-Semitism that was voiced in, say, The United Irishman, one of the publications of the Republican movement, was shocking, quite shocking. And the population, the Jewish population, and not only the Jewish, but the Protestant population, the various denominations that were not Catholic immediately after independence had steadily dwindled. There was no room for them. That's what I felt. And I just wanted to capture, there is a certain sense that I wanted to capture the heroism of what I entered, but I also wanted to capture the ugliness. And part of it was the raw anti-Semitism. And there were Jewish men involved in the movement, but Jack Dalton says it. They're doing it for their own. They're on the make. Mm. That would explain that. So I was just very keen to include that, just to include that anti-Semitism, because the Jewish population of Ireland has dwindled to virtually nothing. Mm. And my mother grew up in an area that had a huge mixed population in terms of religions, and it seems to have been a very cosmopolitan type of part of Dublin, and now it seems to be largely gone. And I think it's a shame. I think it's a great, great pity. And it's something that, our record during, for example, what we called the emergency, what you called World War II, was also appalling. That our unwillingness to open the borders to refugees was just staggeringly, it was verging on criminal. And I wanted to capture just that, the existence of anti-Semitism at that time. So that's why it was the coincidence of reading those two books at the same time, really.
Yes. Finally, that when one finishes the book, I suppose that the authorial voice seems quite cynical about and almost bitter about some of the things that happened at the end of the process.
Yeah.
And some of it seems quite surprisingly anticipatory of what's been going on the last year or so.
In terms of what's going on in the north?
In the north.
Yeah, well, the parallels when I was reading it were quite staggering. At a time when I started, very depressing, because it seemed that, it's some sort of a line that will never be bent. Mm. I think things have changed more recently. I think at the moment things look pretty bad. I haven't seen the news or read a paper in a couple of days, but it looked pretty bleak. It's the old posturing again, the bowler hats and the trup-a-doop, and then, but it'll never be the same again, I suspect. But I think Mo Molum and Billy Hutchinson and people like that who have they've brought new words to the table and new attitudes to the table, and I don't think it'll ever be quite the same again. But the parallels were quite staggering. But I feel myself, I think it is at the moment, we've got this Celtic Tiger bullshit that's been forced down our throats for the last 5 or 6 years. But
explain what that is?
What the Celtic Tiger is? So I was an article in The Economist about 5 years ago which announced that the Irish economy was roaring, and it explained, it was actually quite a good article, really. It tried to explain why all the money was coming into Ireland and why suddenly from a huge unemployment rate it was dwindling, and why suddenly the house prices in Dublin were astronomical, and why things generally in Ireland were looking good, and why tourism was no longer the only growth industry. So it's been a burden, really, on our shoulders ever since, and it's one of the most awful cliches, this Celtic Tiger, this, that, and the other. And there's a lot of sneering about it now, as if somehow we should not be happy that there is less unemployment, that we've become smug, that Dublin's just like any other city. I remember the days when we queued to get out of Dublin because we wanted to go to any other city. And now we have a bit of variety. We still have the blandness, we have Tesco's and the rest of it in the high streets, but just off them it's still Dublin, and I'm very happy, I've got to say, very happy living in Ireland, and I can live freely now, whereas 15 years ago, if I said I'm an atheist, I had to explain it, I had to justify it, now it's the other way around, it's quite nice, I really like the place, and I think it took a long, long time for Ireland to recover from what happened. And what happened, I think, is my own personal opinion, is that basically the same system, the same regime continued, except the accents changed and the men on the make changed. It was, you know, and I think it took decades and decades for Ireland to recover, you know, and it was one brand of oppression was replaced by another, almost fiercer brand of oppression. And times are more subtle now, times have changed now. So there is an anger there, yeah, I think so, because I think a lot of the men, particularly in the GPO, those socialists who were in the Citizens' Army, you know, they, some of them who died, you know, it wasn't, what came about in 1922 was not what they wanted. And what was there in 1986 was not what they fought for. And I get angry because I see people like Charles Haughey, greatest thug and thief and bollocks ever born in Ireland, as far as I can see.
Keep going.
Yeah, well, more words would be superfluous. I think bollocks actually captures him quite perfectly. But, and he, you know, was, you know, claiming some sort of fraternity and some sort of continuance with the men of 1916, you know, and I just felt that it was wrong, you know. So I suppose, yeah, I'm in the book, you know, my opinions are in the book. Although I tried to make Henry Smart live, but we'd have a good chat. If he existed, I think I'd have a good conversation with him, and I think we'd agree on some fundamental things.
Would anyone in the audience like to ask anything? Somebody over there straight away. There's a microphone coming for you.
Reading your books, I'm struck by, I know the area that it's a lot of it is set in. How much of you is in the books, particularly Paddy Clark, which is to me, a very autobiographical?
Well, it may seem autobiographical, but you don't know it's autobiographical because you know precious little about me. It's not autobiographical. It was inspired by memory, to be honest. The story really has nothing to do with me. The story, I never watched my parents' marriage break up. But I suppose the flavour of it, the texture, the geography of it, the television, the radio, the garden, the grass, all that sort of stuff was inspired by memory. When my first child was born, I started thinking about my own childhood a lot. And I'd just finished my third book, The Van, and I was very keen to move away from that and to see if I could write something else. So it struck me as a good idea at the time to see if I could maybe use the memories and create a fiction out of it. But it's not about me at all, really. And I don't think, my mother reckons that if I had been, you know, in Paddy Clark, and my brother, I do have a brother, had been in Paddy Clark, that it would have been reversed, that I would not have been hitting him. He'd have been hammering the shit out of me. So my family's reaction to it when they read it was, I think, possibly my own reaction when I was writing it. When they read it the first time, it felt very familiar. You know, I remember my sister saying when she read it the first time, she felt that I had invaded their life. But then when they read it the second time, she realized, no, that's not the house I grew up in. No, that's not my brother. No, you know, so I used my past, but I wasn't interested in capturing my past. My parents, as far as I can make out, are still very happily married, you know. So it's not autobiographical. I suppose what I was trying to do was make it seem like it's autobiographical, because it's a boy writing, shortly after these events. So it had to seem as if it was real. But I get lovely letters now and again, you know, overwhelmingly from women wondering, hoping that my life is happier now. I can't answer them, you know. Yes, it is. but there's very little, strictly speaking, there's very little of me in any of the books. But, you know, in The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, I suppose, you know, she's a woman, I'm a man, so there's nothing familiar. But we're roughly the same age. And she walks home from the dance, the first time she meets Charlo and walks home from the dance, that's the route I took walking home. And it's when she dances to Frankie Valli and My Eyes Adored You, that's the music that was played when I went to the dances, you know, so there's a coincidence there. Her feelings towards her children are the same as mine, you know, the pride and the anxiety, things like that. So I'm in there somewhere, but it's not about me. Does that answer your question?
You've gone from a style of writing that, looking out from the outside, is all about voices and just voices being heard. And there's voices, sure, coming through in from Henry. But you're going from voices to visions, and it invites the comparisons with invites comparisons with the Tin Drum and Salman Rushdie, Midnight's Children. Is this the millennium novel for Ireland?
No.
And what are the other two episodes in the trilogy that we now have to wait 10 years for?
No, it's not. I can't help it that the millennium is just coming up. I wish it wasn't. I really do wish it wasn't. I couldn't, you know, myself, I'll sort of wave a flag at midnight for the simple reason that my family will be up, and I'd rather just go to bed and ignore it. But I think that would be just a bit too self-consciously hostile towards it. I don't care about the millennium. You know, I expect the world to continue the day after as well. So there's no... And most of the world, anyway, as far as I'd make out, isn't acknowledging the millennium anyway. It means nothing to them, you know. So I don't really care about it. It just happens to be the end of this century. Luckily, the story will be the new century will be well on by the time I'm finished the third volume, you know, if I'm around to do it. So, no, it's a coincidence. The inevitably, I suppose, when you're writing a story in this way, there are comparisons. There are thousands and thousands of novels out there. So inevitably, there are comparisons. I have read The Tin Drum. I've read it several times, and I love the book. And I was confronted, well, with the decision, can I describe Henry's birth, because Oscar in The Tin Drum did that already. And I said, yes, I can. I'll just make it his own, you know. And I mentioned Illywacker. And you mentioned another one now, which I've Salman Rushdie. Yeah, the comparison's being born at a significant time. I was bringing Henry back as far as possible to make sure that he was old enough to be at these significant events. So he's nearly born at the beginning of the century. You know, he deliberately misses it by a year, or it was 2 years originally until my interfering editor discovered my maths problems. But so he just misses the beginning of it. I'd much rather if the Revolution of the Rising had been in 1919. It would have suited me down to the ground, so that he could have been born a bit less near, you know, if that makes grammatical sense, the beginning of the century. So I'm not actually, I'm not saying no to your question, but I'm saying, yeah, I would acknowledge that having read lots of books, I go and write a book of my own, and I've always acknowledged where Blackwater, The Shape of Blackwater, that novel by Joyce Carol Oates, helped with the shape of my book, The Woman Who Walked Into Doors. The subject matter of Richard Ford's book, the name of which I cannot recall, the one, it's a 40-year-old man looking back at a time when he was 16 and his parents' marriage was breaking up. I can't remember what it's called at the moment.
No,
not The Sports Writer.
Is it Rock? Not Roxbury's.
No, it's not. Roxbury's. Sorry, I can't remember the name of it. But it was very much, Wildlife was very much in my mind when I started Paddy Clark. So yes, other books feed me. I've read, novelists don't read novels when they're writing. I do, and because I enjoy it and I love it. And I'm always writing, so I'd never be able to read again. So I do, and you know, sometimes they come back. You know, the notions, ideas, images come back, and I don't actually copy them as much. I sort of, they're presented. You know, somebody said, I think I was doing a seminar on film writing, and some clown from some college or other stood up and said there are only 7 stories, and he was sort of sneered at so much that he never got a chance to explain it. There may be just 7 stories, but there are infinite ways of telling the stories, I think. I read a review from an American paper recently that said that the Henry Smart is based on the Cú Chulainn legend, and went and accounted for it. You know, apparently Cú Chulainn's dad had a missing leg or an arm or something like that. No, I didn't know that. I didn't know he had a father at all. I'm not familiar with I'm not familiar with the Cú Chulainn legend at all, really, other than the fact that he played hurling and it was in a big battle, and is now bronzed in the GPO on there it is again on O'Connell Street. I wasn't familiar with the legend at all. You know, so it's a coincidence. But it's now part of the official package that I was doing a rerun of the Cú Chulainn legend. Have I answered your question?
Second and third installment.
Oh yeah. Well, the answer to the honest answer there is that I don't know what's coming. I plan as I write, you know, and I'm doing a lot of reading on the second installment. I've actually started writing. He's in Chicago in the late 1920s, and without giving too much away, he has met Louis Armstrong. who, as you all know, was a member of the IRA and had to get out of Ireland. He was, unlike Michael Collins, Louis Armstrong couldn't walk through Dublin without fear of being arrested. Well, the one, were you always good at English, is a question which is hard to answer because, you know, I don't know. But I remember there was one teacher in primary school who seemed to think I was, and there was a Christian brother in secondary school who seemed to think that I very definitely wasn't. In my final year in secondary school, I could not say or do or write anything that would please this old person. So I don't know the answer to that question. I was never particularly good at anything. At all. You know, I don't care anymore, but at the time, I always managed, you know, to survive, to not get myself noticed, you know. And I never failed, but I never shone or excelled at anything at all, you know.
Who was your favourite novelist?
I don't know. When I was a kid. I used to read all the William books, so I suppose Richmond Crompton is the answer to that question. But luckily, I'm an adult. I don't read Richmond Crompton anymore. It's for children. When I was a child. Yeah, I've read all of Nick's books. Do you want to know what I think of them? I think they're great.
I wonder if you could say a little bit more about something you touched on before the discussion started, which is the significance of Henry being a supporter of James Connolly, the militant socialist, as opposed to, for example, being a supporter of, you know, somebody like Pádraig Pearce, the militant nationalist. Mm. And also, I mean, you said something that kind of struck me. I mean, you talked about kind of sneering at the whole 1916 rising, and then finding out that your grandparents had been involved to some degree or other with the IRA, which is something I found out about my own grandmother recently, which, you know, I nearly died of shock when I heard it. I mean, it was something that was denied, I'd never heard of.
Not you what know, you normally would expect of a grandmother.
Well, exactly, really. Exactly. And I mean, I'd just be interested in your attitude to the whole kind of nationalist revolution, and whether you still feel it's something you sneer at now, because, I mean, when you look at that period of history, and I appreciate your book is a novel, and it's not a historical work, but it was something that involved huge numbers of people that did have an aspiration to live in a better kind of society.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that aspiration mightn't have been realised, but the motivation, it seems to me, was a genuine one.
Well, the motivation of many of them was a genuine one. I wouldn't disagree with you there at all. Which is, well, you see, Henry clung to James Connolly, for want of a better verb, because it seems that, you know, it, from the background he came from, there's a jump in the story, deliberate jump, from the age of, I think, 10 to the 1916 rising. And I didn't want to do the 1913 lockout, the general strike in 1913, because it's in Strumpet City. And unlike some other episodes that I was paralleling, perhaps, I didn't think I could write about the 1913 general strike or lockout without aping and copying and robbing James Plunkett's book, Strumpet City, which I've read, I suppose, once a decade, you know, four times. It's a beautiful book, and I think it's brilliant. And I knew the characters would be there, and I wouldn't get around them. I wouldn't be able to invent something new. So I jumped to the 1916 rising, and I thought that James Connolly would be somebody that Henry would believe in. He would speak the language that Henry understood. Henry knew that he grew up in the circumstances he grew up in because fundamentally his parents, his grandparents, his great-grandparents never had any money. And it was about money, and it wasn't about, you know, it was economics. And that James Connolly was in the GPO for very different reasons to a lot of the other men. And the men with James Connolly were there as well. They were internationalists, they were socialists, they were revolutionaries. It wasn't just a change of accent they wanted. Connolly, after all, was Scottish. It wasn't a change of accent they wanted, it was a change of structure, a change of regime. And I think the genuine ideology in the Proclamation of Independence was there because of Connolly. Henry had no time whatsoever for the Irish angle of it, the language, the dancing, the name changing. He had no time for it at all. And members of my family did, you know, many of whom I didn't know. But it's Henry Smart's story. And I think there was also just an awful lot of hatred, just pure hatred of England and everything English. And that lasted then, right up to, you know, when I was in secondary school, there were Christian Brothers in the place I went to who wouldn't allow us to play soccer because it was a garrison game. It was an English game. You pick the ball up, boy, you know? And it wasn't part of, you know, and we were almost forced at times to speak Irish. And, you know, English was our language. I don't know, because all, as far as I know, both sides of my family all came from the east coast of Ireland. We grew up, they grew up all the way back speaking English. Like Irish, as far as I can make out, was probably never part of their culture. And yet there was this one blanket Irishness that was inflicted on us. There wasn't even a pop music station in Ireland until 1979. And there were all sorts of attempts to keep foreign culture, jungle rhythms, all the rest of it out of Ireland so we have something pure. And even then, even when Riverdance arrived, about four or five years ago, the big debate was, well, it wasn't really Irish dancing because they moved their arms. Because Irish dancing is designed for the expenditure of energy but no sexual content whatsoever. So the arms are nailed to the knee or thereabouts, you know. So, that you know, there was just, Henry came out of, you know, Henry survived the conditions that he grew up in. And he knows that those conditions were going to be obliterated. It was James Connolly who was going to do it. And Henry, later on in the book, he says that James Connolly, if he hadn't been executed in 1916, a bullet would have gone into the back of his head sometime later. You know, because he was awkward and cranky. And I wouldn't disagree with him. You know, and in fact, I think possibly a bullet would have gone into Pádraig Pearse's head as well. Because he had a different, he was ideological. It was the men on the make. You know, I'm not sure if you've read the book or not, but it was the Ivans and the Alfie Gandons, the guys who sniffed the air and realized that there was a change coming and hopped at the right time. They would have made sure that these guys weren't around to deflect them or to interfere with them. Have I answered your question?
I think we take one more. The mic's just coming round.
There you go.
It's too late.
I just wanted to ask, have you always wanted to write? When you were teaching, were you a long time in getting to start writing?
I suppose because I read a lot from very young. I was very slow to start reading. I do remember that in my class in primary school, there were 57 at one stage, 54 boys in a classroom. Reasonably enough, the teacher didn't realize that I myself couldn't read. I managed to sort of smile up and beam vitality or good health or whatever, but I couldn't read, and my mother noticed this. So I think once, a bit like Granny Nash, once I learned how to read, I haven't stopped since, you know. And so there would have been the vague ambition from childhood all the way up. I was lucky insofar as when I was in UCD, the college, one of the colleges in Dublin, friends of mine who had a college newspaper called, imaginatively enough, Student. we were minimalists, Marxist minimalists, invited me to write. They enjoyed, if you like, conversation with me and reckoned I could write good satire, and I started writing satirical things for them. That was the first time I was in print. And I kept on at that, little bits and pieces for a magazine called In Dublin for a while, and then I started teaching and stopped for a couple of years. But the teaching was great insofar as there were a lot of holidays, for example, and I didn't have a family or any other responsibilities. So I got out of Dublin for one summer and came to London and got a flat in Wood Green and just went down to the local library every morning and stayed for as long as was tolerable and got into the habit of writing. And by the time then I went back for the new term in September, I had a big collection of paper and really I couldn't ignore it. So I got gradually on and off into the habit of writing. But it was always there, yes, I'd always wanted to write. One of the great things about it is that, and it's a big assumption because recent statistics would indicate that 25% of people in Ireland can't read, probably have difficulty reading. So it's a big assumption, but assuming that you can read and write, you have it. You know, whereas I'd love to have been a musician, but you can't just pick up a guitar, you have to learn it. And I never had the patience or the skill to learn formally. And I'm not very good at learning, that type of thing, you know. It seemed easy to be a writer. So I'd much rather have been a rock star. Now it suits me fine, because I'd be a rather pathetic rock star at this stage. And of course, a bit of a footballer, I'd be knackered at this stage, wouldn't I? I'd be long dead. There'd be, you know, they'd have pictures of me with the hair, you know, the mullet haircut, and they'd be laughing at me. So in the long term, being a writer is not as sexy as being a rock star, but it's the career seems to go on for a bit longer.
It goes on forever. So did you write The Commitments in Wood Green?
No.
So you're not. I was
he knows the answer to
North
this question.
London
he knows it. No, I wrote a novel that's never been published, and never will be.
That was Ian Wood Green.
Yeah, well, half of it. Not quite half of it, but quite a big chunk of it. My memory of it now is a bit vague. The writing conditions, but it was Wood Green, the library in Wood Green. Yeah,
well,
it was
we'll get a plaque up for you.
Do yeah, that'd be lovely. it was called Your Granny's a Hunger Striker, and. Most of the imagination and the flair went into the title. Badly downhill after that. But it's a pity, really, because it's a great title.
It is.
It's a great title, and it's a shame. And but the rest of it is... It took me 4 years to write, and when I was finished it, I felt this sense of elation that it was finished. It was a great Irish novel. And I sent it off to all these publishers in Britain and Ireland, and in most cases it came back unopened, and that was the message, you know, don't bother your arse. So... I had started writing The Commitments at this stage, and I felt very good about it. But that was written in Dublin in 1986.
Yeah,
sorry.
Okay.
But I published it myself then. And at the risk of sounding arrogant, the rest is history.
thanks very much, everybody. And thank you, Roddy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just one very quick announcement. I do urge you to read this remarkable book. Fortunately, we've got copies for sale outside. Even more fortunately, we've got the author here to sign them. We've also got copies of Nick's books. They're out in the corridor, and I'm going to invite Roddy and Nick to take up their positions at the signing table in a moment. But would you just join me once again in thanking Roddy Doyle and Nick Hornby?
Thank you.
Thank you.